Several times in the last couple of weeks on our prayer letter, Paul had major heart surgery. It's great to see you here this morning. You know, and we just pray that what happened is not going to recur again. You know, and you go from strength to strength. It's great to see you. So today, I should have done this last week. If you remember, I got it wrong. I got the dates wrong. But this is seeking to put love where love is not. And isn't it amazing how many songs we sing do have this word love in them? You know, how many times we repeat this word love. And I know when we put these statements together, it took us ages. It took us ages trying to formulate something that could be just help us to see what we're trying to do. But what I realize is that no matter how long it took us to put it together, they're just words on a piece of paper. Because unless there's some reality behind what we're writing, it means nothing. It's like having a shop in the high street that's got a nice display, but then when you go indoors, there's nothing. You know, and some of these are hard to put into practice. That's why we put that word seeking to be. Because these are, they could be stock phrases, but we want them to be more than that. We want them to be a reality of how we live and what, as a fellowship, we think is important. So, you know, it was being high on acceptance and low on judgment. It was honouring Christ in all we do and all this seeking and seeking to put love where it's not. So it's quite easy to say these phrases, but what do we actually mean by seeking to put love where it's not? I mean, wouldn't it be good to even try and get a definition of what love is? I mean, would anybody just like to just shout out, what do we mean by love? How would you describe love? Anybody? Just words, even in a one word. What, how would you describe or how would you show love?
Love has no boundaries.
Sorry?
Love has no boundaries.
Helping others. Sorry?
No offense.
Kindness.
Taking no offense.
Who's been reading 1 Corinthians 13 then? Acceptance. So all these things, when we think of love, if we put that into our statement, isn't that what love means? So much more than just a four-letter word. Do you know, it can appear from our statement, putting love where love is not, that we're actually thinking about somebody who's got no love at all in their lives, and we're going to come along and we're going to put love in there. You can't think that from the statement, putting love where it's not. But actually, it could be just one event. It could be just one situation where love might need to be shown. There was, most of you might have heard of a great missionary, German missionary called Albert Schweitzer. Big, tall, blonde guy. And apparently Africa, I think, was his main mission field. But he was visiting an American town. And the train was pulling. You know, the Americans have these big trains, you know, and you actually come down from quite a height. So the train pulled into the station, was in the middle of the town, the town band was playing, the mayor and all the dignitaries were waiting for this great missionary to be welcomed in the town. So he stands on the edge of the train and he can see over all these people and he's about to walk down the red carpet to be welcomed. But he sees something going on beyond the crowd. And he sees a little black lady carrying a huge suitcase to get to a bus. So the mayor steps forward to say hello. He says, excuse me a moment, I'll be back in a minute. He walks along the platform, he goes round the crowd, he goes to the little black lady, picks up a case, takes her by the arm, takes her to the bus, puts her on, puts a suit, gives a case to the conductor, whatever, he puts it away, and then he walks back again, gets before the mayor and says, right, now we're ready. And there was a reporter in the crowd, and he said, that's the first time I've ever seen a sermon walking. So it was one incident, put in love. At that moment, somebody needed something, and he saw something. So let's look at what this one word love encompasses. We've got many different understandings, but it might help us to try and understand what the Bible meant when it used this word love. What's the implications from the Bible? The Jews and the Greeks weren't limited like we were. We have one word for love. So I can say this, some of you will love Manchester United, won't they? And I can't see him. Ethan, because I like Manchester City, Ethan always comes to me and commiserates with me and says, feel sorry for you today, and things like that. Some of you like donuts. So you love donuts. There's a group you might, you know, you really love a certain kind of music. Or you love film stars, or you love this. Or you might even love your wife. Or you might love your children. But actually, it's the same word. So we can love a donut as much as you're loving your wife. That's what it sounds like, because it's the same word. And actually, you might love the donut more on certain occasions, but it's this word love. I thought it might be interesting. Just, is this thing doing this? If I shall I take this bit of tape off, or is that what's doing it, Andy? Shall I try it without? Can you put it off, John? Just in case it is that. Is that? I don't know. So if we look at some of the original biblical language, so if we go to the Old Testament, written in Hebrew, just some, these words mean love, but different understanding. So one of the words they use is Ahab. And this means spontaneous, impulsive love. And in the Old Testament, it's used more than 250 times. And if you know the story of Samson and Delilah, I get a picture of that kind of love. He was impulsive. He was impulsive in his who he wanted to love. If you read the story, you'll find out. I mean, it got him into so much trouble. It really did. Impulsive, don't think about tomorrow. This is the moment. And I wonder if part of that is what our culture is suffering from at the moment as well. This impulsiveness, don't think about tomorrow. It's the day today. That's one form of love. Another Hebrew word was hesed. And it meant this, it was a deliberate choice. You chose to love, a definite and deliberate choice of affection and of kindness. Feelings aren't mentioned here. Feelings aren't mentioned, which is interesting because we're a very feelings-based culture. But in the Old Testament, love could be a choice. Abraham had Isaac. Nice. Abraham was getting old. He said, I want Isaac to have a wife, but I don't want him one of these Canaanite women where we, I want one from my own people. So he said to his servant, go back to my own people and find a wife for Isaac. He's not going with you. You go and choose one. But if you read the story, it's in Genesis chapter 4, the servant prayed that God would lead him to the right woman. And so he finds the right woman who he believes, and he brings her back to Isaac. And the story says, Rebecca is in the on the camel, whatever. And when she sees this guy stood in the field nearby, she said to the servant, who's that? And he said, that's my master Isaac. She puts a veil over her face. And Isaac meets her. And this is what it says. The servant told Isaac all he had done. Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah, never seen her before, till that moment. He married her, so she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. This word hesed, he made a choice to love. Not on feelings. And actually, this could be used for the words of arranged marriages. I mean, when we were in Palakonda in India, talking to Victor, they've actually had arranged marriages for some of the orphans from the, and some of them last, because there's a choice to love. Not just because feelings change, don't they? Feelings change. So perhaps one of the most important aspects of putting love where love is not is when we choose to love. Even when everything looks as if, how can I love in this situation? We choose to love, and some situations might not appear lovable. The people you're looking at might not appear lovable, but you make a choice. You're going to love anyway. Story I heard a long time ago is about a woman called Isabel Chapman. And I relate to this because she did the same job I did when she worked for the Prudential. And she was called to be a missionary. And she had to go and tell her district manager, which it was like when you went in there, you wondered what he was going to say to you. It was such a high position in those days. And she had to tell him. She called to be a missionary. He told her she was mad. Absolutely mad. She sold a house and she was called to the Philippines. And she relates the very first meeting that they took her to was a mountainous village. Took quite a long time to get there. And she said it was almost like seeing a Stone Age people. They were dirty, hardly had any clothes on. They were filthy, the hair was matted, lice crawling through the hair. There was kind of all stuff in the children's eyes. Their eyes were matted. There was pus coming out of sores. And virtually every woman in the village had a goiter. And isn't that a lack of iodine? Is that correct? It's iodine. Every woman had a goiter. And she looked at these people and she thought, how can I love these people? How can I love these people? They're dirty. And she actually says she turned away. She turned away from them. They were so appalled by the sight. And she prayed. And she just adds, God's Holy Spirit, would he fill her with that love of God? She prayed in tongues, and in a few minutes she turned back, and everything had changed. And she went to the first woman and child. She just wrapped her arms around them. And she placed a hand on one of the goiters, and she began to pray that God would remove it. And she physically felt the goiter shrink beneath her hand. But then this took over, and she said, this can't be happening. And it began to grow again. And so she cried out to God, please don't let this stop. I'm sorry for my own unbelief, the carnal part. And the goiter went. Every woman in the village had the goiter removed. Other miracles took place. But she chose to love. Through God's help, she could love what was unlovable. And it's powerful. Another word they use is raham in the Hebrew, and it means brotherly love, compassionate, brotherly love. Again, I heard a story, and so I've got a lot of stories this morning. I hope you don't mind. A pastor was called out 10 o'clock in the evening. Called from a husband and wife, their child, 18-year-old boy, just been injured in a motorcycle accident. Is in the intensive care. So he goes to the hospital, and as he arrives there, he sees the doctor has just been speaking to the couple, the parents. And doctor's just walking away, and he comes up to them. And they've just been told their 18-year-old son has just died. And he said, I couldn't say a word. So what they did, they had a kind of hug together, and they just all cried. That was it. The family moved away. And years later, they met up again, and they said, the one thing we remember about that night is you cried with us. That is this word, I think, this brotherly love, compassion. You know, you've become part of what's going on. So love gets involved. It doesn't stand at a distance. You know, we can love people at a distance sometimes. We can give for something over there. It's harder when you actually get face to face with some of these situations. But this is the Hebrew word raham, brotherly love, compassionate love. But the Greek words also, they have more than we have for love. They have several, but I just want to just mention three. And some of you have heard this before because we're kind of talking about similar things. So the first Greek word I just want to tell you about is the word eros. It's the erotic love. It's the sexual side of love. And again, this is very tied to the Hebrew word ahab. It's the impulsive love, the sensual love, you know, feelings again. This is the kind of understanding this word pulls up. And you just wonder how many marriages and friendships have broken down because of this type of love. Don't think of consequences. Don't think tomorrow. Come on, it's good for the moment. And it's this kind of love. And what I have to say, this word eros is never mentioned at all in the New Testament. It's not mentioned at all. So maybe that should show us what kind of loves we should be avoiding and what kind we should be following and going for. Plato defined this kind of love as aspiring for and delighting in the value of its object. In other words, loving that which is lovable. That's that kind of, you love what's lovable. But we aren't called just to love the lovable. We're called to love those who are unlovable. Isn't that what our statement means, put in love, where love isn't? And then the other Greek word that we could mention is philia. And again, this has got a tie up with brotherly love. And obviously we get our words Philip from this, and Philadelphia is brotherly love. Jesus mentions this word quite a few times. If you look at what, when he's talking about his own family, when he was called to go and see Lazarus, when Lazarus had died, the word used there is filio, it's the brotherly love. And so we see, we read these stories, just says love. But they're different types, it's giving different understandings and different meanings. And the next word is agape. Now this is very seldom used in Greek literature, apparently. Very seldom used. And it's often referred to as a kind of a selective love. And there's a book called the Septuagint. David will correct me if I get this wrong. 70 scholars translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek. And they used this word, agape, when it was meaning God's special love for Israel. They used this word over 300 times in their translation. This is the word they used when they talked about God's love for his people. So it's got a very strong understanding. But this also became the most prominent word in the New Testament. Over 250 times this word agape is used, and it kind of took on a new meaning in the New Testament understanding. It wasn't just about a selective people, it was a kind of a love that went higher than just brotherly love. It took it up a different level. It was a different notch. And it's used so often. A new commandment I give you, agape one another. The fruit of the Holy Spirit is love, agape. For God so agaped the world that he gave. All these are endued with the same word, the same understanding of this, almost in the new covenant, it's not a creative word, but it's certainly taken on a higher significance. I'd like to read what some of you quoted earlier from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. So I think Phil's going to put it on the screen for me. I can't even see where Phil is. Oh, he's there. 13 fits right in the middle of 12 and 14, okay? And you do wonder why it's put in there. Because 12 is all about the body, being endued with Holy Spirit gifts and gifts of pastors and teachers and leadership, but also about the body working together. And then 14 goes on about desiring spiritual gifts. But right in the middle is this. And I don't think it's coincidence. And I think he sets out why. In fact, I think the end of chapter 12 says something like, and now I will show you the most excellent way. But I think he gives a bit of a warning in the first three verses. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have any love, I am nothing. This word is agape, by the way. It's not filio, it's not any of the others, this is agape. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. So he's setting the context there. You can have all these wonderful gifts of Holy Spirit, can appear brilliant to everybody else, but actually if you haven't got love at the root of it, Paul is saying it's going to be hollow. It's going to be like a clanging gong. It's not going to get you anything. And then he gives this list. Can I just say, it also say God is love, and the word there is God is agape. And this is the same word, agape is. You could actually quite easily translate that this is God is. Quite easy. Same word. You could almost say that. So love is patient. Agape is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, it always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres, as we've heard this morning. Always persevere. Love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where are their tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall fully know, even as I am fully known. And these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. The greatest of these loves is agape, specific word. And as I say, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God, and God in him. So God is love, that's his character. It's the essence of his whole being. And it's not just his acts that show God is love. It's because God is love that he does his acts of love. He can't deny himself. God always loves you. He'll always do acts of love to you. Why? Because that's his character. Whether you deserve to be loved or not, that's what God does. So let's just look at some of the things Jesus did, how he showed love. The first one is love touches the untouchables. I mentioned the one about Isabel Chapman. That was almost like an untouchable situation. But love touches the untouchables. The Jews have a very strong religious code. Some people could be an outcast religiously. The story's told of a woman who'd been had an issue of blood, had been bleeding for 15 years. When a normal woman's monthly cycle was on, she became religiously unclean. So imagine someone, a woman, had a problem like that for 15 years. She spent all her money. Doctors couldn't do a thing. If she sat on a bed, no one else could sit on it. Else they would become unclean. Couldn't sit in a chair. Else they would be contaminated almost. They'd be just religiously unclean. And then they'd have to do special purification things. So imagine living with somebody like that for 15 years, religiously unclean. And one day she sees Jesus in the middle of all this crowd. She's at a wit's end. Where else does she turn? What can she do? No more money left for doctors, and it's not worth. But there was something about Jesus, she thought, something about this man. And so with everyone else, she crept up in the crowd. And she reached out her hand and she just touched his garment. And I'm just thinking of some of these films where, you know, they freeze it. And it was like something stopped because Jesus stopped. And he asked a question which his disciples thought were absolutely ridiculous. Who touched me? Everybody's touching him. They're all around him. But Jesus recognized a touch of faith from just a casual encounter. Fancy knowing power's just gone out and he looked, because he knew power had gone from him. Fancy knowing power's just gone out of you. And the woman knew that actually she couldn't hide. So she told him what she'd done. Just imagine all the religious implications. A rabbi and an unclean woman touched him. He could have said, "What are you doing here? How dare you?" But he didn't. He simply said, "Your faith healed you." No rebuke, because his love was so powerful for the untouchable. But he was also socially outcast. There was a day when they'd all been up the mountains, Jesus had been teaching, and they were all coming high spirits, I don't know, after lunch, down in the afternoon. And they're all coming down, all the disciples, and suddenly, Jesus, somewhere in the middle, the crowd stops. They just stop. A quietness comes on the crowd. You think, they've all been shouting and rejoicing a minute ago, why now? So Jesus pushes his way to the front, and what does he see? I think it's one of the most pitiful sights. He saw a leper. Stood in the road. I would think, knowing the context of their times, probably quite ragged, face may be covered, because leprosy can be quite deforming. These boys, people just stopped. An outcast. Supposed to shout unclean as he was going round. Had to leave his home, his family. I don't know if he was married and had children or not, but he couldn't go and see them. Great fear about leprosy. So what does Jesus do? Everyone else is stood at a distance, but he goes. And what is untouchable, humanly speaking, he reaches out and he touches the leper. Goodness knows what the disciples would have been thinking. But as he's touching him, the man's skin begins to change and blood starts to flow and healing starts to take place. It's shown, I think it's shown brilliantly in the DVD of Matthew's Gospel with Bruce Marciano, this encounter with the leper. And by accident in the film, while they were rejoicing, they both fell over and they ended up rolling in the ground together by accident, but they've kept it in. There's so much rejoicing because, you know, for a leper, a social outcast, he can go home now. He can go and see his family, maybe hold his wife again, hold his children. You know, once he was outside. I just wonder sometimes of how many times there are untouchables in our own lives. I told you about Isabel Chammer, but even last week, Sylvia Cutting just mentioning about the towels. For her to start with, didn't want to touch them. How many situations do we get involved in, or could we be, where? And yet Jesus touched the untouchables and the untouchable situations because of his love. Love allows people to choose. It allows people to choose. Remember the story of Jesus when he came to Bethesda and there was somebody by the pool, a lame man, and the story was an angel every so often rippled the pool, and if you could get in before the ripple stopped, you'd be healed. And here's a lame man, and Jesus said, "Do you want to be healed?" And he said, "Well, every time I get to the pool, everybody else is there before me, and by the time I'm there, it's too late." But he asked the question, "Do you want to be healed?" You know, love gives people a choice to say yes or no. And so often, we don't always give the people the same freedom. You know, we desperately want so much good for their lives, but Jesus never forced his opinion on anybody because God made us to have free will. So everybody has to choose. We cannot live other people's lives for them. People have to choose, and love allows them to choose. Love allows people to choose. Love allows one to be free, just as God intended us to be. Fancy God forcing us to love him. What would that mean to God? Who wants to be loved because you're forced to love? And so we come to the inclusiveness of love. We love because God first loved us. And God so loved the world that he gave. Every man, woman, child in the world, God so loved. You know, he's not just loving us, he loves all mankind. It says, "Greater love has no man than this, than he lay down his life for his friends." But actually Jesus went one step further. He says, he laid down his life for his enemies as well. Those who hated him, those who were killing him. There's a story told some years ago of a man who was conscripted into the American army, a Christian man. And a Christian man, and he had a habit of reading his Bible and praying. He was in a big dormitory with all the other guys, and of course, he became the butt of their jokes. Laughed at him, ridiculed him, made fun of him. But he did it anyway. And one day, these guys thought, "We're really going to have a bit of a joke with him. We've got to go on the range tomorrow," and they were throwing hand grenades. just as training. But what one of the guys was doing, they're going to get a dummy hand grenade. He was going to drop it in the center of the room and shout out, "Live grenade." And what they want to see how this Christian, what is he going to do? Going to laugh at him as he's trying to hide or scurry, he's trying to get out of the room. So the time came then, they were going to do it, and he got back in the billet and Waterman dropped this hand grenade in the middle of the room, and he just shouted out, "Live grenade." So all those in the joke, they started trying to get out of the building, dive under beds, behind metal cabinets, whatever they could do. But without an instant, what the Christian guy did was throw himself on the grenade. In an instant. And everything in that room changed. They'd ridiculed him, they'd laughed at him, but in an instant he was willing to put himself in danger to protect them, and it changed. It's exactly what Jesus did for us. Exactly the same. But what about the power of love? The power of love that can change situations and circumstances. The power of love. A young guy had his first car. Was messing around with it on the drive. Mother was inside, and she suddenly heard screaming from the drive. She ran outside, and the jack that was holding the car up had collapsed, and the boy was underneath. People were running who'd heard the screaming. She got hold of the car, and she lifted. And she lifted it enough that they could drag the boy out. She broke her back in the process. The power of love. Power of love that can take the worst of us and make us into a thing of beauty. And what about the focus of love? A woman had four children, and one day a reporter must have been doing a story on her, said to her, "Which of your children do you love the most?" What a question to ask. But she said this, "The one who's sick until they're better again. The one who's away from home until they come back." Jesus said there was a man who had 100 sheep, and one got lost. And he left the 99 to go and find the one. Does that mean that the lost was more important than the 99? No. Just at that moment, the focus was on the one that was lost. You know, you can think sometimes that God is more interested in the lost than he is in you. I don't believe that. I don't believe he loves the found any more than the lost. It's just that his focus, he wants the lost to be brought in. So again, where's our focus often? Are we thinking of those who don't know Jesus? You know, it takes both. We look after each other. We love each other, but also keeping our eyes open for the lost. And what about the blindness of love? The blindness of love, not put off by race, colour, prejudice, background, fallenness. They're too dirty for me to touch. There's a story about a medic during the First World War. He was going through a battlefield after numerous battles. And he was just walking among the injured. He heard a young German soldier, a young boy, and all he was saying, crying out, was "Mutter, Mutter." And a tank had hit him, and he was obviously dying. So this British medic knelt down beside him, kind of took his hand, comforted him, and he just simply said, "Mutter's here. Mutter's here." And the young boy died. You know, aren't we called not to be put off? It's easy to say, isn't it, about race and about colour and different understandings, but we're called to love people, aren't we? God's responsibility to save them. And what about the restoring power of love? The restoring power of love. I'd like to, and again, some of you might have heard this before, but I just think it fits so well in our understanding of love and how Jesus deals with us. You know the story of Peter. He denied Jesus. I read it again this morning. When he was asked, did he know Jesus? You know, when Jesus had been arrested and Peter denied it, we think he just said, I don't know him. He called curses down upon his own head. He cursed himself to show that he didn't know him. He didn't just say, I don't know him. He called curses down upon himself to show to the people asking him, oh, no. You know, he couldn't just say, no, I didn't. He had to prove it, so he cursed himself. And 40 days later, just as Jesus is about to ascend to heaven, he calls Peter aside and he wants to talk to him. And I'd like to read you the story as it's recounted. And then I'd like to just change some of the words around as I've been discussing about difference in words. So when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Now Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said, follow me. I'd like to just change some of the words here and put them into the Greek words. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you agape me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said. You know that I filio you. I love you like a brother. Jesus said, feed my lambs. And again Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you agape me, this highest of loves? And he answered, yes, Lord, you know that I filio you, I love you like a brother. Why couldn't Peter respond with the same word? Because I believe he didn't want to be a hypocrite. Because 40 days earlier, first of all, he said, I'll die with you anyway. Then he totally denied Jesus. So how could he say to Jesus, and the understanding that word, I love you with this greatest of love that would even give my life for you, when actually he couldn't? So what he does, he steps it down and says, actually, but I do love you like a brother. So what does Jesus do? Does he say, well, you can't love me enough then? I don't want to know you until you can love me with this love that gives everything for me. Is that what he said? No, he didn't. This is what he says. Simon, son of John, do you filio me? Do you love me like a brother? Yes, Lord, you know I love you like a brother. Jesus came to where he was. Why? Because you read in Peter's letters and he talks about agape love. He'd found it. He knew what it was. And the story is that Peter was crucified upside down because he didn't feel worthy enough to be crucified the normal way. So Jesus didn't put us down. He's come to lift us up. And the strange thing is, he's come where we are so we can be lifted up. He doesn't say, I'm up here, climb your way up. And I'm saying this because there's people out there that we need to get alongside to help them up and not stand at a distance and say, we're up here, come and join us. The power of love, the restoring power of love. Just like to watch a YouTube clip, very brief, But before I do, I just want to read a couple of Mother Teresa's sayings. I looked them up the other day, and these are powerful. She said, "Not all of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love." She said, "If you judge people, you don't have the time to love them." Not all of us, I'm sorry, I've just done that one. "Every time you smile at someone, it's an action of love, a gift to that person, a beautiful thing." Do we believe that? Your smile can actually be almost like a gift of love to somebody who might be having a miserable day as you walk by. We're so British, we don't actually like to commune with passing strangers, do we? "The hunger of love is more difficult to remove than the hunger for bread." More difficult to remove than the hunger for bread. And just one more. "I'm a little pencil in the hand of a writing God who is sending a love letter to the world." We're little pencils that God takes and he uses us to send a love letter to the world. And aren't we told by their love, people are going to see Jesus? Jesus.